Parshas Chayesara begins with the story of the purchase by Avram of the Maris Machpelah, the field that eventually that had the Maris Machpelah, from Ephron the Chiti, and from the community of Bnei Ches, various Chitim in the community. The Torah describes the whole story about how he asked Bnei Ches to help him find a suitable place to bury Sarah. And they said, sure, we'll help you. And they went to Ephron, and he told Ephron, I want this field. And Ephron said, no problem, I'll give it to you. And Avram said, I'll pay you for it. And he said, fine, he took the money. So the Torah, throughout the Torah keeps mentioning that the Bnei Ches were involved, not just Ephron himself, but the whole episode, the Bnei Ches keep getting involved. It says, Ephron Yoshe Betoch Bnei Ches. Avram said earlier, he bowed down to the people, to Bnei Ches. He told them, please help me get the field. Later it says, he spoke in the hearing, in the presence of the whole community. Amaretz in the old-fashioned usage often just means the populace. Later it got a derogatory meaning. It means the people who are not learned, who are not so observant. But here it just means the people in the land. Yeah, exactly. And later, the Torah finally concludes the story by saying, "Vayakam asadav amara sherbo, the field and the cave within went to Avram lachuzas kever meis bnei ches. It became a kever from bnei ches." So again, we would think of this as a simple real estate transaction. Avram bought a parcel of land, a field with a cave from Ephron. Yet the Torah, throughout the story, keeps on emphasizing the involvement of the bnei ches, of the entire Chittite community. Why is that? So a number of Rishonim, several of the Tosafist school from the Bali Tosfos and the Ralbag, as we'll discuss soon, a number of the Rishonim offer more or less the same explanation. They argue, they explain, that in addition to the sale of private property from Ephron himself, there was also another transaction that was required from the community or from the government. And they explain as follows. The Chizkuni, for example, says, Avram needed the cooperation of the entire Chittite community, because even after Ephron sold him the title to the actual piece of land, Avram still could not have used the property to build a cemetery without getting permission from the whole city. That's why he had to propitiate them, he had to bow down to them. And that's the idea, because if a person wants to make a cemetery, it's not enough to own specific title to the land, you also have to get permission from the community. That could be. I'm not sure. I'm not going to get involved in that today. That could very well be. But in terms of what his goal was, the Chizkuni explains that it is not permitted to build a cemetery on property that you buy unless you also get permission from the community. We find other of the Bali Tosfos, the Hadar Zakenim, a compilation of Pirushim of the Bali Tosfos, the Riva. They explain Avram had to get permission from the Gedolei Ha'er, from the leaders of the city, the nobility, the government, whoever it was, to build a cemetery. That's why he had to ask them permission. And that's why they infer, if you read the Pesukim carefully, all the way to the end of the story, when it says that Avram succeeded in acquiring the field, the Torah says, Vayakam stay Ephron twice. First, the Torah says in Pasuk Yudzayin, Vayakam stay Ephron asher b'machpelah. It says that the field got up, Rashi says it means it transferred ownership. And then it says again, the Torah says twice, the transfer, the kinyan, what Avram did was two things, two vayakams. Why? So they explain, first, again, you have to get specific title to the property from the owner, the holder of the title, like in all real estate. Additionally, if you want to build a cemetery, you have to have a second transaction. You have to get permission from the Gedolei Ha'er, from the Moshel, from somebody in charge, from the community, in order to build a cemetery. The Ralbag has the same idea, and he finally actually relates this to the halacha itself. The other Rishonim just say this is what you had to do in old-fashioned Canaan. The Ralbag explicitly says that this is similar to the halacha of the Torah. The Ralbag says, it's actually a lesson, he says, you learn from the story. A person is not allowed, he says, to use his property in such a way that will injure, that will harm, that will annoy or inconvenience his neighbors, unless he gets their permission. That's why, he says, when Avram wanted to build a cemetery, he had to buy the cemetery, not just from Ephron, but he had to also get the permission of the whole community, Meis B'nei Ches. They all had to sign off on his use of the property as a cemetery. And Ralbag, the punchline is, the last line he says, "Ukvar hotziu chazal mizeh sharash dinim rabim mekamas mibastra." This principle that a person should not do anything, even on his own property, should not do anything that will inconvenience or injure his neighbors, is a sharish, is a fundamental principle that Chazal derived from this many halachas in Maseches Bava Basra. And indeed, cemetery actually is one of the specific halachas that you're not allowed to do without getting permission. The Mishnah in Bava Basra, Perek LaYachbar, that's the second Perek in Bava Basra, that's where many of these halachas are concentrated. Ralbag says Mekamas Rabim, they're also in other places too, but primarily in LaYachbar. So on Daf Chaf Hey, the Mishnah says, Marchikin Esanavolos, Vesavelos, Vesakvaros, Vesaborski, Meneir, Chamishim Amma. A person wants to build a cemetery, he has to move 50 amas outside the city. So again, I don't know exactly where Maris Mapela was, whether it was inside the city or outside the city, but the basic idea is, Chazal understood, the halacha is that a person is not allowed to build a cemetery just next door to a residential area. He has to give a certain distance. Rashi explains, Mishum Reach Ra. We're dealing with odors. I don't know. Odor. The Velas is a slaughterhouse operation, basic forest. I don't know how much odor there is, but in general, it's considered inconvenient for the neighbors, unpleasant for the neighbors. And that's what all these Rishonim say. They're all Bag, the Kaskuni, the Balitosis. They all say the same thing, that this is an example of what we call Nizkei Sheinim. Nizkei Sheinim literally means damage to neighbors, damage by neighbors, to neighbors. The Rambam has an entire section called Hilcha Sheinim, which are the laws of neighbors in general, of which a major subset in Shulchan Aruch too, there are several simanim called Hilcha Nizkei Sheinim, the laws of damages, of injuries to neighbors. Now, as we noted in the language of the Rishonim, some Rishonim, when they say you have to get permission, some Rishonim say you have to get permission from the whole community, some Rishonim say from the government. And when we think of modern law, that would be the analogy of this in modern American law, local law, state law, county law, whatever it is, we have zoning laws, which are the laws that require, if I want to build certain types of structures, I have all kinds of rules that govern what I can do. I can't build commercial things in residential areas. I have to have setbacks. I have to have trees. I have to have drainage. I have to have parking. I have to have this. Well, all these laws are laws that are, you know, that are passed by the government that are meant to protect neighbors from doing things that would too severely inconvenience the neighbors. Additionally, I'm not an expert on the laws, but additionally, there are what we call nuisance laws. If I have loud parties at 3 o'clock in the morning, the neighbors can complain. The neighbors can file a complaint, and the government will enforce that. Typically, in zoning laws, you go before a zoning board, you have to get permission, you have to get variances, you have to, all kinds of rules, obviously. Anyone who's built or, you know, will know about this. And nuisance laws just regulate what you're allowed to do on your property. And in halacha, all these things are basically included in what we call Nizkei Sheinim, the laws that govern the injury of neighbors, injuries that neighbors do to each other, are all included in the general category of Nizkei Sheinim. Nizkei Sheinim are actually, if you look at the organization of the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, they're actually not included in the regular categories of Nizakim, the regular laws that govern car accidents or fist fights or, you know, the famous ones you learn about the Kama, the Shor, the Bar, the Eish, these types of things. These are all in a very separate area of halacha. These are in the halachas of neighbors, of partnerships, of kinyanim. And most of these halachas do not deal with b'di'evad. Most of the halachas that we're going to discuss today of Nizkei Sheinim, the issue is not, I did this, I injured you, do I have to pay you? There is some discussion about that, but the primary concern is just like the modern analogy, the modern analogs of zoning and nuisance laws. That's what Nizkei Sheinim is about. Neighbors, partners, people have to live together, and you have to have some kind of regime that determines what's allowed, what's not allowed, what can I do, what can't I do. Again, the primary signifier of Nizkei Sheinim, the primary signature aspect of it is that I'm really doing things in my own property. You know, regular Nezek, I punch you in the nose, I hit your nose, I burn down your house. Nizkei Sheinim is fundamentally things that I'm doing in my property. I'm simply operating my business in my property, and that's always the defense in all the tshuvas and all the discussions of Nizkei Sheinim. The defendant always says, I think I should be allowed to do this. I want to be allowed to do this because b'shali ani oseh. I'm working inside my own property. Additionally, many poskim stress, and we'll see some specific examples of this soon, some of the specific guidelines. Poskim often stress that when you're dealing with Nizkei Sheinim, you're not dealing with necessarily unusual or aggressive or uncalled for behavior. You're dealing with normal living. Parties are normal. Maybe parties at 3 o'clock in the morning are not, but you're dealing with normal way, normal lifestyle, normal things that a person might do in his own property. The question is always going to be, how much of that does halacha allow? At what point do we say, Ad kan, I know you're doing this in your own property, but there's a limit. You have to take into account your neighbor too. So that's what we'll discuss today, the halachas that determine what a property owner is allowed to do in his own property, what he's not. The rules themselves are complicated and highly technical. Additionally, much of the specific examples discussed in the Talmud and discussed in the early poskim are not really relevant today because the configuration of neighborhoods has changed, the types of things people do has changed. It can be, and it is, very difficult to translate the specific examples discussed in the Talmud to our modern situations, but we'll at least discuss some of the principles and discuss some of the modern tshuvas, modern examples, modern discussions of this to get at least a feel for how the halacha treats neighborly behavior, what you can and what you can't do.
Perfect example of that.
Yes.
Suppose you live in a condominium, and the condominium has a certain value, roughly, and then one person decides to sell the property for much lower than the market value. The result is that everybody that owns a piece of property, the value of their property will go down because one person decides, I just want to get out of here, I'll sell it for half.
So that is a very good question, and these types of situations are discussed by the poskim. This type of question basically breaks down into there are two aspects of the question that I'll touch on today. One of them is, in general, real estate, forget neighbors. Anytime you have a market with a number of players, a number of sellers, and there's a more or less stable price, airlines, grocery stores, car dealers, real estate, anytime there's a more or less stable price and one operator in the market wants to start a price war, wants to start selling stuff, a one-off sale like a condo or an airline that wants to slash its fares to pick up passengers, and the other merchants are upset, the other merchants say that you're disturbing price stability, you're causing a ruinous and destructive price war, it's bad for all of us, is that a complaint? That's something we're actually not going to discuss today. That's discussed more in the laws of Yari Lomnus, the laws that regulate competition in halacha. This is some stuff that we covered in our night call last night. We'll actually be covering it maybe a little bit again soon. We discuss mechachtos and related topics. We probably will discuss at some point too price competition and price stability. But that's something, unfortunately, that we're not going to get to today. There is, however, another aspect to Phil's question, which I do want to discuss today, which I did prepare some material on. That is, broadly speaking, we're going to discuss today, the Gemara gives examples of many, many different kinds of nuisances that are objectionable. So, for example, Beis HaKvaros, Rashi says the issue is the odor, the smell. We're going to discuss noise. We're going to discuss hammering and banging, construction, occupations that make noise. We're going to discuss traffic, different kinds of commercial operations that increase the traffic level on the street or on the joint property, the building, people coming in and out of the stairwell. There are discussions about privacy. These are all individual causes of action. I'm telling you, don't make noise, don't make traffic, don't make smell. What about a case where what you want to do does not fit into any of these categories? There's nothing you're doing that objectively would be considered a problem according to the laws of Niske Shteinim, but you can show, we can ask a realtor, this will lower property values. One classic example that used to come up a lot back where I lived in Lakewood, and I think it comes up all over the country, is cell phone towers. Whenever a cell phone carrier wants to build a cell phone tower, so there are all kinds of worries that there'll be harm to the neighbors. Now, the science on this is mixed. There's a great deal of debate about whether the electromagnetic radiation is carcinogenic, at what distance. So in some cases, it might actually be hezek. If the radiation is indeed dangerous, then you're dealing with classic hezek, and that would be something you could object to. Let's say, for example, we establish that as far as halachic is concerned, at this distance, at this level of radiation, there is no danger. Let's say objectively, again, halachic, the burden of proof is always on the plaintiff. The one who objects has to establish his claim to basin satisfaction that there's danger. Let's say he can't do so. Let's say he can't prove there's any real danger from the radiation. What he can prove is that cell phone towers are unsightly and that people don't like them and people worry about the radiation, even if it's not scientifically established. These are all facts. These are all demonstrable facts. And he can demonstrate conclusively that real estate prices will go down. If I rent, you know, very often the cell phone towers rent rights from the individual property owners to put towers on the roofs. So if the cell phone company wants to erect a tower on its roof and the neighbors complain that, forget about all the objective questions of hazard, we can't prove that. We can prove that our property will go down in value. Is that grounds for a complaint LP did?
That actually happened in University Tower.
Oh yeah? Cell phone tower?
Yeah, the board was considering to approve a cell phone tower on top of the building, and for which the company would pay the condominium.
Sure.
But the people who were like right under their apartments were right under that. They were complaining that, hey, you know, good, maybe good for the building to get income, but you're putting us in danger.
Right. So again, so the actual right, it happens all over the country. So the actual danger again is beyond the scope of this topic. We're just going to work on the assumption that the unsightly thing. Let's say, for example, another issue that comes up is these windmills, you know, the green energy and all that. They want to build windmills to generate power. So one of the objections is always that they're ugly. People don't like them. So again, is that a claim? If I build a windmill on my own property, it's not harming you in any way. Your main claim is it's bad for property values. When I sell my house, it'll go for less than it would if there was no windmill down the block. Is that a claim or not? So the primary source here is a tshuva of the Rush. The Rush was talking about an interesting case. They used to have seats in shul like we do today. Unlike today, where you simply pay a fee to the shul and you get the right to sit in a certain place, on Rosh Hashanah, or maybe all year in some places, in those days they treated seats in shuls as real property. You owned it, you could transfer it privately between one person and another. It was really considered a partnership in the shul. You couldn't build a store there maybe, but the right to sit there, it was considered a real property right. You could buy, you could sell, there were contracts, there were disputes about them, they could be seized by creditors. It was considered a real ownership of a place in the shul. So there was a certain situation, I don't know exactly what this looked like, but there was a row, either vertical or horizontal, there was a row of seats, and there were no partitions or dividers between the seats. We never really have those in shuls, but apparently in some shuls back then, they actually had, I guess like in theaters, you have boxes, you know, in some shuls they actually had, at least for the more expensive seats maybe, they had divisions, they had partitions between the different areas, the different seats. So a person, Reuven was, let's say, on the front of the line, and Shimon was next in line. But right now, there were no partitions. So Reuven and Shimon were basically both more or less in the front. Reuven wanted to erect a partition in his own property. The seat, let's say, gave him 4 feet or whatever it was, 6 feet. He wanted to erect a partition in his own space. He wouldn't take any space away from Shimon. He wants to partition off his own seat to have his own box. Shimon objected. Why? Shimon said, because being in the first tier, in the first area, is chashuv. That's a good seat. If you build a partition, I will now be in the second seat. I guess the fact that he was second in line wasn't so bad, as long as there was no partition. But if it's fenced off and you're in the after the first partition, that's an inferior seat. And one of his claims was that, you know, I paid good money for the seat, and if you build your partition, then my seat will be worth less. The Rush argues that is basically not a valid claim. That the Rush first discusses the claim on its merits. Is the partition okay or not okay? He says it is okay, and he says the mere fact that your seat will be worth less due to his building a partition is not a claim, unless you can show a specific claim according to the laws of Chash and Mishpat, the Gemara, the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch. Unless you can show a specific reason why what he's doing is not acceptable, the mere fact that your property will go down, that does not itself give you a right to compel him to stop doing what he's doing. And this is invoked by various later poskim as a major principle in halacha. If you can't show a proper cause of action, a formal cause of action according to the halachas that govern these areas, the mere fact of a price injury is not in itself a reason to get the guy to stop. We have, for example, a tshuva in the Beis Yitzchak. He had an interesting case also. The case was there were two partners who owned a home together. And the rules of taxes in this town was, the rules were that a house which was not rented, which was resided in by the owner was not subject to certain taxes. However, if even part of the house is rented out, then the entire house is subject to real estate taxes. So the Reuven and Shimon owned the house in partnership. Shimon wanted to rent out his portion of the house, which is fine. And normally when there are two partners in a building, either partner can sell or rent or transfer in any manner his portion of the property to somebody else. The problem was, by doing so, the house would then become classified as a rental property, and even Reuven's part that was not being rented out would then be subject to real estate taxes. So Reuven objected. Reuven said, by renting out your house, you're harming the value, you're causing it to become taxable of my house. Beis Yitzchak basically argued that is not a claim. According to this, Rashi says the rule is, if you can't show me a direct injury that I'm actually harming you, I'm making smell, I'm making noise, you can't show that I'm actually harming you directly, the mere fact that your actions are causing my property to be worth less, that is not in and of itself a hazard.
Is that really causing it to be worth less, or it's causing him to pay?
Can you speak up?
He's causing him to pay tax, to pay something, not just that the property will be worth less.
So what's the basis for the ruling?
So
is there a basis for the ruling?
So the basis is this Jewish Arush, that any time I don't cause you direct harm, but I cause price depreciation, there's no claim. You know, Hillel is just asking that the issue there seems to be not primarily about the value of the house going down, it's merely about the cause of me to have a tax bill every year, which probably also affects the value of the house. I'm not sure. It is a long tshuva. He does go through a pretty freewheeling discussion of all kinds of other general analogs to this idea that indirect hezek, where I'm not really causing it, I'm just causing you to have expenses, or indirect. So yeah, the tshuva requires more carefully, and I agree, but he does begin his discussion by invoking the Rush as a precedent. I'll just mention briefly two other cases, in modern cases, in the Basin of Yerushalayim, Rabbanut Basin of Yerushalayim. One case involved a school, Shiva, some kind of school in Yerushalayim that was doing some construction. They wanted to, I'm not sure exactly what they were doing, they wanted to add a small wing and put the bathrooms in there. There were a number of different claims by the neighbors. They argued they weren't leaving enough of a setback because they were expanding the building too far out. They argued that they were moving the door to a different part of the building so it would increase traffic. They also argued that the new bathrooms would cause increased smell. As we mentioned, there are actually halachas in Baba Basra that govern the placement of bathrooms. So again, the exact rules of Chazal about the bathrooms are technical and complicated, and it's not always so clear how they apply. I'm not going to get involved in the technical details of what bathrooms are allowed or not allowed, but for our purposes, I just want to note that after all these specific discussions about setbacks and bathrooms and traffic, the fourth claim of the neighbors was, in general, they said, putting aside all these specific claims of harm, our property, if you go ahead with this expansion project, our properties will be devalued. Our properties, we have reason to believe, will go down in value. So that itself is an additional reason we want you to cease and desist from your plans. So the Beis Din analyzed these individual claims, try to determine whether or not they have merit. And again, the exact details are beyond the scope of our discussion. But they address this fourth claim about the property devaluation, and they say, again, the Yesod is the Rush. Anytime you cannot establish hezek objectively based on the specific technical objections, the mere fact that value will go down is not itself enough of a reason to object. They have a similar psak in another case. This case involved a private home in a residential area. This is a very common question. They wanted to open some kind of small daycare in a private house. And again, like an apartment building or a condominium where the neighbors were not happy. The neighbors worried about the noise, worried about the traffic. The neighbors didn't want this daycare operation. And one of the many objections they said they raised was that if there's daycare in the building, the apartments, the condo units, like Phil said before, will be worth less. And again, the basin approached it the same way. They said, we'll discuss it a little bit later, maybe noise, some of the other things may or may not be considerations. If they are, then fine. Then you can object based on the inherent problems of the noise or whatever, the traffic. However, if we determine for various reasons that those complaints are not complaints according to halacha, and the mere fact that you also threw in the concern with property devaluation, that is not in and of itself a basis to object to what they want to do. That's all the same attitude based on this rush. This is a very important thing. You have to show actual hezek. Simply raising the question of property devaluation is not enough. Now, we keep mentioning noise. So noise, indeed, is one of the cases discussed in the Gemara, Mishnah, as well as one of the most common questions that comes up today in dealing with nuisance, zoning, and halachim, niske shkainim. Noise, indeed, is one of the most common shalas that arises. The concerns today are very similar to the same concerns they had in the time of Chazal. Unfortunately, the clarifying what the halacha is, the treatment of the halacha, is very difficult to reach a maskana. So let's discuss briefly, reach a final verdict, a clear rule. It's not going to be so simple, but let's go through, starting from the Mishnah down to the contemporary poskim, try to understand what the issues are of making noise. So the Mishnah says, if someone has a chanus, a store, a shop, inside a chatzer, so yachal limchas biyado v'lomar, the neighbors are allowed to object, they're allowed to say, eini yachal lishon mikol hanachnasim mikol hayotzin, I can't sleep because of all the traffic, all the customers, all the traffic, people going in and out. Aval, he says, he's allowed to operate his manufacturing plant, he's allowed to make stuff there, osakalim in there, as long as he sells them outside. And even though so there are no customers coming in because the actual retail outlet is somewhere else, even though he's manufacturing the kalim in the chatzer, that's okay. Not allowed to object because the hammer is making noise. So for some reason, the beginning of the Mishnah says you're allowed to object from the noise of the traffic. Some Rishonim say it means actually the noise of the traffic. Other Rishonim say it means just the inconvenience, the bustle, the lack of privacy of the traffic. But one way or another, traffic, including its noise, is a valid basis for objection. However, hammering noise, manufacturing noise, production noise, is for some reason not a reason to object.
Does it make any difference what means open?
Yes, it makes a very big difference, and that's an excellent point, and that is what we're about to discuss. What time of the day he's doing this. Just a brief shortcut, the contemporary poskim, when they discuss these questions, they invariably start setting rules. Is it after 11 o'clock? Is it in Israel? Is it during the 2 to 4 hour people sleep? Is it before 7 o'clock? Contemporary poskim approach this question almost entirely from the time of day considerations, but we'll build up to it and show how the poskim got there.
So in the chaser, you cannot object the beating of the hammer,
right?
But you can object the traffic.
Yes, that's what the Mishnah seems to say at face value. We'll see if that's the actual halakha or not. Customers, people coming in. Not vehicular traffic, just pedestrian traffic, just the bustle, people coming in, people running in and out. People don't want people running in and out all hours of the day. So the basic question is why? What is Tzad of this Mishnah? Why is the hammer less of a concern than the traffic of people coming in and out? So there are two main opinions in the Rishon. There's the Rambam, and there are other opinions. The Rambam understands that really, even hammer is an objection. You can really object even to hammer, and that is how the Shulchan Aruch paskins, that you can really object to hammer too. When the Mishnah says you can't object to the hammer, the Mishnah is speaking about a case where he already has a chazakah, he already has been doing this for a while, and the neighbors have not objected, so he gets the right. This is a rule that happens all over Baba Basra, that once you've been doing something for a long time and the neighbors haven't objected, they're assumed to have tacit acceptance. It's a principle that's beyond the scope, again, of our discussion. But for our purposes, we'll just note the Rambam's opinion is that even the hammer is really something that, up front, when you first start doing it, you're allowed to object. The only time you can't object is if he already has a chazakah, he's already been doing it without protest for a while. Other Rishonim say no. Other Rishonim say that noise, for some reason, is not as much of a problem as traffic. Traffic, halacha views, is a more serious problem. Noise is not something you can object to. The question is why. It's not so clear why. But in terms of the halacha lemaisa, there are indeed two shitas in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch himself rules like the Rambam that without a chazakah, you're allowed to object even to the noise, even to mere noise. Ramah says, no, anything a person does, at least if it's for his livelihood in his own home, is okay. A person is allowed to do l'chatchila. Traffic, for some reason, is worse. Traffic is other things besides noise, loss of privacy maybe, other considerations, just getting in your way, taking up parking spaces, whatever it is. Traffic is worse, but mere noise is not something that you have the right to object to. So halacha l'maisa, there is a dispute about whether you can object to noise or not, whether noise is a claim or not. Now, we should also note there are shitas that say, and I don't know if anyone disagrees, but there are certainly explicit shitas that say that all this discussion about noise being an objection, we've been discussing today two kinds of situations. We've been discussing, well, Phil mentioned the condos, where basically there are partners who own individual units and they share the building as a whole, but they each own individual buildings, individual units in the building. In the time of Chazal, this was the arrangement commonly. You had a chatzar, for example. The chatzar was jointly owned by the resident, and each resident had his own house. Or sometimes there was a mavoi, there was like an alleyway, which was sort of privately owned. And the mavoi had multiple chatzeras had multiple batim. But again, there were these areas which were kind of jointly held. There were these joint private alleyways and joint chatzeras. Those were the situations Chazal were often discussing. There are poskim who say that these considerations of noise only apply in these jointly held areas. Like in the condos, if one neighbor is making noise, the other neighbor can object because they jointly share the building. But if we're just what we call shchenei harachov, neighbors on the street, but we share nothing in common, we're just neighbors on a public street, there's no objection at all. This shita is most discussed at most detail, most explicitly by this Kan Aaron, or Aaron Walke and the Pinsker of. He was writing in Poland, basically, right before World War II. Specifically, he was writing in the year 1938. He says there was a blacksmith who used to live in the villages, and he had his operation out there in the village. And because things were getting pretty grim, something to do with the anti-Semitic persecution, doesn't say exactly what it was. He says it was dangerous for Jews to live in villages. They have to go to the cities. Not sure what was going on, but it was something, some kind of unpleasantness leading up as a prelude to the Holocaust. So the blacksmith has to leave the village and move to the city. And he began to operate his blacksmith shop in a second home he had in the city. He had a neighbor, an elderly accountant. He said the fellow was old, and the fellow used to, his living, he says, was, he used to be Osik b'cheshbonos, he was mechashiv cheshbonos, and right, some kind of clerical profession, sounds like an accountant. The neighbor said, I can't deal with all the noise, you're hammering away, I can't deal with it. I can't, my health is weak, I get headaches, I can't deal with this kind of noise. So the Kan Aaron discusses whether the noise itself is an object, is a reason to object or not. One of his points, he says, why basically, with one major exception, noise should not be an issue is, so all the Talmudic, all the earlier discussion of the postum of noise is only, again, as we said, when they share one property, they share a building, they share a chatzar. Neighbors who simply have adjacent properties, but they're both neighbors of what he calls Shechene HaRachov, neighbors onto the street, there's no basis for objection. And the Divrei Chaim, the Sanzerov, Rav Chaim Halberstam, also makes the same point. He says, all the discussion about noise, according to the different poskim, the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, all these different shitas is only when they share a chatzar, when they share some property. Mere neighbors, Shechene HaRachov, there is no objection to noise. Now, the truth is it's not so simple, because there is one major exception to all this, and this is based on a tshuva of the Rivash. Rivash was much earlier, back in the 14th century. The Rivash was talking about a case, someone had, again, some kind of commercial operation, weaving. Apparently there was a lot of clattering of the loom when they made the cloth, the loom banged around, and it created a lot of noise. And a neighbor objected. He said his wife gets headaches. It hurts her head, whatever that means. So the Rivash says that this is a valid claim. Even though the Mishnah says that noise is not a basis to object, he's going lefi the shita of the other Rishonim, not like the Rambam, that noise is never an objection to begin with. Says the Rivash, that just means when noise is annoying. When noise is inconvenient or annoying or unpleasant, that's when you have this whole discussion, and the Rivash says, we paskin that noise is not grounds for objecting. However, if a person is ill and the noise actually causes harm, doesn't define what harm is, but if the person actually is harmed by the noise, then he says, absolutely, it's usur, and he brings various rayas. He says, anything that causes actually harm to people who are weak, people who are not well, that certainly is something you have the right to object to. This Rivash is brought by the Ramah. Ramah says, daf adam briyim, even after he brings the shita, that noise is okay. He says, only if the neighbors are healthy. But if the neighbors are ill, and the noise hurts them, that is grounds for objection. And all the posts can bring this thing in. Anything which causes objective harm is a real concern. However, the poskim say the burden of proof to demonstrate that this is real harm is on the plaintiff. Plaintiff has to show, get a note from his doctor, or either he has to show that this level of noise is such that is injurious, a decibel level, whatever it is generally considered injurious. Or you have to show if it's your particular, if it's your particular problem that you are injured by the noise, you have to show based on evidence that you will indeed be harmed by the noise. And if you can, then we will indeed compel the neighbor not to do what he wants to do. And that's what the Zakan Aaron himself, Rav Wolkin, concludes, that if the Kantan simply says he doesn't like it, he finds it annoying, that's not an objection. But if he can show that he will be harmed by it, his health is weak, his head is weak, whatever the issue is, he'll actually suffer harm from the noise, that is grounds for an injunction. Now, you mentioned before the time of the day. The time of the day. What time?
Traffic is about the traffic.
Traffic is considered more serious. If you're bringing traffic into the property, you're bringing people coming in, customers, people coming in and out, that is more of a that is also usher. Still, as Kanaran says again, that only applies where there's joint property, where we share the buildings, so you're coming into my hallway and my chutzner, but just neighbors, two houses next to each other on the street. Traffic on a public street, it seems, is not a consideration. It's only if it's traffic into jointly owned property.
This also was a case with the Warwick. Mm-hmm. Several years back. You remember what happened? They did a major overhaul of the Warwick.
Mm-hmm.
There was all kind of banging going on, mm-hmm. up and down. And then people were being annoyed by, in their home, people that would stay home, they weren't working, whatever. They would be like shaking because they couldn't get any rest.
Right.
And I know one person in particular that kind of like drove them into like some kind of a nervous condition.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely not good. Right.
So the apartment said, if the noise bothers you, they set aside a separate apartment on the 14th. You can go to this apartment to escape. So they were admitting that it was
causing
it. They should have just said cut the rent, or said we could reduce the rent by a third, whatever. But all these things are like right in this neighborhood.
Absolutely. So the classic discussion of the time of the day issue comes up in a tshuva in the Chasam Sofer. Somebody wanted to open a bar, a place that sold liquor in small quantities to customers, we would call a bar. And the neighbors objected. They said that the traffic, again, the main problem, I don't know if they were also singing loud drinking songs or not, but the traffic, again, the commotion, the bustle of a bar was not something they wanted. So the Chasam Sofer's correspondent, not the Chasam Sofer himself, the other rabbi who asked the question to the Chasam Sofer, wanted to argue that, what's the problem of all this noise, all this commotion? Eini yachalisha. The Mishnah says, I can't sleep. That's the problem if they're doing this at night, when it's a normal time to sleep. But if it's during the day, then it shouldn't be a problem. That's what the Chasam Sofer's correspondent held. The Chasam Sofer himself rejects this. Chasam Sofer himself says, no, it's a problem even during the day. And he explains the reason why he's concerned even during the day is because he says, the Chasam Sofer says, you're right, sleeping mainly occurs at night. However, he says, during the day, the mere inconvenience is also a consideration. He says, Ein la manoach, I don't have peace and tranquility because of all the commotion and noise. Also, there are children, he says, asleep during the day. Also, he says, people, even if you start, you open your doors at 9, but the workers are coming in, they come in earlier, and they start earlier. So the Chasam Sofer mentions the children and mentions just the peace and quiet during the day, too. It's Kan Aaron himself goes even further and says, he discusses this question too, about what if he's only going to work during the day. He says, well, a lot of people sleep during the day. He says, many people take naps during the day, especially older people, he says. And he actually goes so far as to say, on the contrary, he says, it's more of a problem during the day than at night. He argues that at night, it's a natural time for sleeping. People fall asleep deeply. A little noise won't wake them up as much. He says, during the day, people are more sensitive to noise. So whether you accept that or not, this is a machlokes poskim, whether noise is a problem during the day or not, and during the night and or during the day. Some poskim say noise and bustle and commotion is a problem both during the day and at night. Some say it's a problem only at night. But again, as I mentioned earlier, contemporary poskim typically do try to set rules for things which are considered normal daytime things should not be done at night, and they try to make up like artificial time, 7 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock at night, not in the afternoon in cultures where they take a siesta like in Spain or Israel or whatever. Poskim do try to make rules that, that regulate behavior to avoid inconveniencing the neighbors too much. Now, one key halacha, which is a kula, comes from a Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish is discussing this rivash, that anything which is exceptionally noisy, anything which is to the extent that it causes harm, either because people are particularly weak or because the noise is so bad that it causes harm, that gives a basis for objection. Chazon Ish makes one major objection. Chazon Ish says that's only something which is what he says is not ikar dira, is something beyond basic living in a house. For example, commercial operation, banging or weaving, running a store in your house, that's not essential to the quiet enjoyment of your home. So don't do that if it makes too much noise that it causes the neighbor's injury. However, he says, something which most people do, and just sometimes it gets so bad that it really causes the neighbor's trouble, but it's a normal part of living in the house. He doesn't really give examples, but the one example he does give, he brings kind of a raya. He says, a person has babies in the house. Sometimes, he says, babies get up at night and they make lots of noise. So he says, can you tell a person, take your baby out of the house, find a different house because your baby's waking us up? The answer is no. He says, even if the neighbor is sick, even if he says the baby's really causing a problem for me, he can't tell someone he has a baby. What's he supposed to do? So anything which is considered a normal part of living, you cannot object to the neighbor doing. Now, people sometimes want to know, you know, you can take care of your baby in a way to minimize his crying, or you can ignore him and he can cry all night. So the question is, sometimes people do that for sleep training. Sometimes they do it because they're not in the mood of taking care of their baby. So are there any limits at all to babies? Not so clear, but the basic point the Chazon Ish makes is that if someone is doing something normal, like having a baby, and babies, it's normal for them to cry, even if that crying is really causing distress and actual harm to neighbors, the neighbors have to find a solution. It's not my fault that I have a baby who's crying at night. I saw a discussion in Rabbi Shlomo Zafrani's Shimur Mishpat. He talks about a case of someone had an air conditioner, a mazgan, that was really loud. And the neighbors were upset. The neighbor said, you're operating your mazgan all day, and it's all night, and it's really annoying us, and we can't sleep. So what should we do? So Rabbi Zafrani considers the possibility that that's an objection, especially according to this rivash, if it's really causing problems, if it's really causing us to have headaches or really suffer beyond a certain point, beyond mere inconvenience, maybe it's usher. Then he brings his Chazon Ish and says, no, anything which is considered normal, tashmish dira, anything which is considered the normal operation of a home is something which you can't object, and the neighbors have to find a solution then. Again, if soundproofing is an option, you'll get into a discussion. Who has to pay for it? Whose side should you build it on? But this is the basic tension. On the one hand, you have the Rivash who says that anything which is beyond mere annoyance and reaches the level of actually causing harm is a problem, as long as the burden of proof will be on the plaintiff. But as long as he can show he's actually having real trouble, then he'll be able to demand that you stop. On the other hand, you have the Chazon Ish who says that anything which is considered normal tashmish dira, like babies crying, or an air conditioner, according to Rabbi Zafrani, you will not be able to object to. Shlomo Zafrani, who's a Syrian posek dying in Eretz Yisrael, a number of Sfarim HaKadosh Mishpat, I admire his work very much.
Contemporary,
yeah. He's a Yerushalmi Syrian dying rabbi.
Living today.
As far as I know, I was good friends with his cousin of his in Lakewood, also named Shlomo Zafrani. I want to just close with one last case, a very very hot topic today, one of the most practical applications of this most of us will encounter, and that is smoking in public places. So the Mishnah, the Gemara, actually talks about smoke. Talks, again, the technical details of the smoke in the time of from ovens, from other kinds of burning. Technical details are not so easy to apply directly to modern situations, but several contemporary posts will discuss whether it is permitted to smoke if the smoke is annoying, bothering, or maybe even injuring somebody else. So, of course, there's general discussion whether a person's allowed to smoke at all. Some posts can feel that smoking today, the evidence is so high that it's so clear that it's dangerous, you shouldn't really be smoking at all, even in the privacy of your own home. Putting that question aside, is it permitted to smoke in a Beis Medrash, in any public place? So again, today we have laws, and today there are laws that govern a lot of these things, and that's a different issue, which is, again, beyond the scope of today's discussion. Dina de Malchus Adina, but putting aside the laws, is it permitted to smoke in a public place? in light of the fact that the neighbors will, that the other men, that the other inhabitants, the other occupants of the space are not happy about it at all. So the poskim here are actually split, and the truth is, it's important though to understand, the poskim who wrote these things wrote them in different points in history. Some of them wrote 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, where the social mores have changed and the appreciation of the danger has changed. It's always very important to note what year any of these tshuvas were written. But on the one hand, we have the Shevet HaLevi, Rav Vosner in Bnei Brak, who says, he has a whole tshuva about smoking in general, Asr Mutter, he's very against it, but he says, Chalila la'ashen mekom ha'tziburim, heaven forfend for a person to smoke in a public place, that the reach itself, the smoke itself is mazik gomer, is secondhand smoke is dangerous, he says, kishon hisbar b'chakira, as has been demonstrated by scientific inquiry. So he says flat out, chalila, to smoke in a public place. Rav Moshe too has a long tshuva on this. Rav Moshe has several tshuvas on smoking, but Rav Moshe has a tshuva written in 1981 where he argues at length that it is prohibited to smoke in a public place. He argues that it's mamash niskeshchenim, you have no right to do things that cause injury to others, whether it's even he says if you're even in a case, and Russia has a very interesting point, even in a case where your minimal amount of smoke would not be causing the problem, it's only if there are 50 people smoking together it causes too much smoke. Very often even one person causes the problem, but he says even if it's only you in conjunction with a bunch of others, even that's usher. Ramosha argues at length also that anybody, any individual can object, the tzibur can object, anybody can object. If you want to smoke in a public place, anyone has the right to object that you should not do that. Ramosha himself was not entirely clear at this point whether he was allowing smoking personally or not. He has an earlier tshuva where he said it was mutter. It's not sufficiently dangerous. Shomer p'sarim Hashem, kiven d'dosh barabim, can't asur it. This tshuva, he doesn't discuss whether it's inherently mutter, but he does say that you can't smoke in a, you cannot smoke in a public place because of our rules of niske sheinim. Rav Eliashiv has a tshuva where Rav Eliashiv is kind of in between these two positions. Rav Eliashiv says we can't really prohibit smoking mikra din. It's a really bad idea. People should try not to, but he says since l'maisa it's very common, gedolim, tovim, people grew up on it, people are used to it. You can't say something which is so widespread, so common, so ubiquitous among humanity. You can't say it's actually usur. Because we have this rule, the rule of Shomer P'sarim Hashem, things which are commonly done, even if they're objectively dangerous, we don't prohibit them. Rav Eliashiv goes further and says, even though the other rabbi wanted to say, that's only on your cheshbon, you want to risk your life, Shomer P'sarim Hashem, fine. What right do you have to subject somebody else to that? Rav Eliashiv says, no, even that is included in Shomer P'sarim Hashem. Brings a very interesting raya. He talks about a certain case of Mila, doing Bris Mila, where Chazal say, in a certain situation, it was dangerous, but the heter is because Shomer P'sarim Hashem. So he says, you want to do it, fine, but the poor baby, he didn't express any consent, so nobody asked him. So Rav Eliashiv says, from this, from other eyes, you see that things which are considered normal, that people do, people don't consider that dangerous, even if, objectively, based on what we know of the statistics, of the actual facts, it is considered dangerous, as long as something is widespread and common and not perceived as being that dangerous, we don't ask her, we don't even ask her doing it when you're affecting somebody else. And therefore, Rav Eliashiv says, you can't actually prohibit mikra din smoking even where somebody else is suffering from it. Rav Eliashiv says, of course, menschlichkeit, human decency, is that you should not do that. Achen, he says, zeh pashut, it's obvious that the smoker himself should be concerned, should have the sensitivity to somebody else, not to cause pain and agmas nefesh to somebody else. And we should certainly, he says, we should try to influence the smoker, gently try to convince him that he should give up his perceived need for the cigarette. And what does Hashem want from you? Be nice to people, he says. But Lamaisi says, we cannot tell somebody else, unlike Rav Vosner, I'm not sure exactly when this was written. This was actually Tavshin Mamal at the same time as Ramoshin, 81. But at least in 1981, Rav Eliashiv still felt that smoking was common enough that we cannot tell somebody Mikra Din that he cannot smoke, even if somebody else is suffering from it. But he certainly says we should encourage him not to, because it's only right to be sensitive to the discomfort and harm you're causing to your fellow men.